Bob Morris entered Harvard in 1950 as a chemistry major. His father had been a salesman for an etching and engraving company, and Bob thought he too might end up a salesman, perhaps at a place like DuPont. He interrupted his studies to spend 2 years in the Army, and when he returned to Harvard, he decided his options would be broader with a degree in mathematics. So he switched majors in his senior year and completed all the remaining math requirements in time to graduate that same year. He earned his master's in 1958 and embarked on his Ph.D., with plans to write his dissertation on number theory. In 1960, he took a summer job at Bell Labs. By the time Bob Morris got there, Bell Labs had as many scientists with Ph.D.s as did most universities. Since its inception in 1925, Bell Labs has been a monument to the degree of innovation that can spring from within the walls of a monopoly. From its considerable investment in both basic and applied research, AT&T has seen ample reward. Bell Labs scientists hold 9 Nobel Prizes. There are few other industrial research institutions like it. Some areas of research were of uncertain commercial value, but it was rare that a project would be blocked simply because its immediate practical benefit to telephony was unclear. AT&T managers were astute enough to recognize that significant breakthroughs are born not of rules or plans, but of people, and those in the upper echelons at Bell Labs governed their hiring practices accordingly. Bob's summer job was to stretch into 2 summers and eventually into a 26-year career. He started out in telephony, working on data transmission, but he was a frequent visitor to the mathematics department, some of whose scientists were developing computer software. Morris made the acquaintance of Doug McIlroy, a mathematician who was to become his boss and close friend for many years. After a year or so, Bob transferred to the mathematics department, took over the job of someone who left, and became so entrenched that there didn't seem to be much point in returning to his Ph.D. work. Besides, he was pushing 30, an age at which almost all of the best mathematicians have already done their major work. It didn't take long for him to migrate into computer research. By then, in the 60s, the field of computer science had begun to burst open with new discoveries. Computers were appearing everywhere within the scientific community. Practically every mathematician who came near a computer had a chance of doing something original. None of those people had been brought up on computers, of course, but all were captivated by them. Mathematical solutions to problems were more and more often complemented by a computer's ability to calculate rapidly. The notion of programming, of being able to instruct a machine to do almost anything, of inventing artificial worlds on a computer, was a source of absolute fascination for McIlroy, Morris, and their colleagues. Morris, in particular, seemed to have an uncanny understanding of computers. Whenever a convoluted computer problem presented itself, bringing it to Morris's attention was almost certain to produce a creative answer. Morris established himself early as a programming wizard. One of his first displays of such mastery came when he joined in on a simple game called Darwin. Darwin was the 1962 invention of McIlroy and a colleague named Victor Vysotsky. Vysotsky thought it would be fun to have a computer game in which the program played against other programs rather than against people. The idea was to create a program that tried to kill opposing programs. At the end of each round, the winning design would be shared with the group. A concept well ahead of its time, Darwin was a predecessor to a later program called Core Wars, a simple computer game that became popular after the advent of the personal computer. Core Wars came with its own simple programming language. Players designed tiny soft war warrior programs, then turned them loose on an imaginary playing field in the computer's memory. The winner was the program that disabled the opposing program and still remained functioning at the end. The 3 young scientists had been playing around with Darwin for a week when Bob came in one day with the toughest survivor of all. Bob's program was composed of just 30 instructions, and its power lay in the fact that it was adaptive. It learned how opponents were protecting themselves and devised its attacks accordingly. Bob's program was unfailingly lethal, and the game ended. Even in an environment where quirkiness abounded, Bob was regarded by his colleagues as an original. Shortly after arriving at Bell Labs, he grew a beard, which was to remain aggressively unkempt for the next 3 decades. An iconoclast by nature, Bob had a habit of challenging others' assumptions, and would go to any length to make his point. But he carried out his challenges playfully, never dogmatically. In answer to a colleague's assertion that all the equipment in the computer room was fireproof, he took a lit match to a computer tape's write protect ring, an attachment that prevents computer information from being erased, and tossed it in the wastebasket, setting off smoke alarms and causing pandemonium throughout the lab. And so acute was his sense of a system's vulnerable points that as his colleagues buzzed proudly around the computer lab on the day a new operating system called Multics was first unveiled, Bob strode in and typed two specific characters he suspected would confound the system. They did. The computer crashed. It was such stunts that earned Bob his reputation as a scientist whose biggest strength was his capacity for offbeat thinking. When he wrote a program designed to spot typographical errors, the program contained no dictionary and knew no English. Instead, it was based on statistical probability. It sifted through a document searching for uncommon sequences of characters, and it found many mistyped words. Bob loved having inside information, and he enjoyed possessing insight into arcana that others were only vaguely familiar with. He often subjected his colleagues to intellectual pop quizzes. If he discovered that someone down the hall had a passing interest in, say, relativity, he would learn all that he could on the subject and start asking questions. It was less a show of intellectual bravado than a sign of Morris's constant curiosity. In a report for the 25th reunion of his Harvard class in 1979, Morris wrote, "A long time ago, I promised myself that I would learn to read Greek, learn in some detail how the planets move in their orbits, and how to decipher secret codes. I have gone a long way toward keeping all three promises." In his 30s, he had taught himself ancient Greek, and one project that occupied him for nearly a year at Bell Labs was an astronomy program for predicting planetary orbits. But the promise with the most relevance to his work at Bell Labs was the third one.